Degoto blinked. Well, anyway, if one of them wants off the street, he doesn't wind up processing paperwork. The department uses his knowledge. The administrative office, internal affairs, organized crime intelligence division, most divisions of the detective services group, they all wanted Spence. He chose the task force. He didn't perhaps solicit the interest of the task force? He didn't need to solicit. Like I said, they came to him. Before he went to the task force, had he been a computer nut? Nut? Decoteau was no longer able to repress his impatience. He knew how to use computers on the job, but he wasn't obsessed with them. Spence wasn't a nut about anything. He's a very solid man, dependable together. Except that, and these are your words, he's still trying to understand himself, come to terms with himself. Aren't we all? The captain said crisply. He rose and turned from Roy to the small window beside his desk. The angled slats of the blind were dusty. He stared between them at the smog-cloaked city. Roy waited. It was best to let Decoteau have his tantrum. The poor man had earned it. His office was dreadfully small. He didn't even have a private bathroom with it. Turning to face Roy again, the captain said, "I don't know what you think Spence has done, and there's no point in my asking." "National security," Roy confirmed smugly. "But you're wrong about him. He's not a man who's ever going to turn bad." Roy raised his eyebrows. "What makes you so sure of that?" "Because he agonizes."
"Does he? About what?"
"About what's right, what's wrong. About what he does, the decisions he makes. Quietly, privately. But he agonizes."
"Don't we all?" Roy said, getting to his feet.
"No," Decoteau said. "Not these days. Most people believe everything's relative, including morality." Roy didn't think Decoteau was in a handshaking mood, so he just said, "Well, thank you for your time, Captain." "Whatever the crime, Mr. Miro, the kind of man you want to be looking for is one who's absolutely certain of his righteousness."
"I'll keep that in mind."
"No one's more dangerous than a man who's convinced of his own moral superiority," Decoteau said pointedly.
"How true," Roy replied, opening the door.
"Someone like Spence, he's not the enemy. In fact, people like that are the only reason the whole damn civilization hasn't fallen down around our ears already."
Stepping into the hall, Roy said, "Have a nice day."
"Whatever side Spence settles on," said Decoteau with quiet but unmistakable belligerence, "I'll bet my ass it's the right side."
Roy closed the office door behind him. By the time he reached the elevators, he decided to have Harris Decoteau killed. Maybe he would do it himself as soon as he had dealt with Spencer Grant. On the way to his car, he cooled down, on the street once more, with Guinevere's treasure on the car seat beside him, exerting its calming influence. Roy was sufficiently in control again to realize that summary execution wasn't an appropriate response to Decoteau's insulting insinuations. Greater punishments than death were within his power to bestow.
The three wings of the two-story apartment complex embraced a modest swimming pool. Cold wind chopped the water into wavelets that slapped at the blue tile under the coping, and Spencer detected the scent of chlorine as he crossed the courtyard. The burned-out sky was lower than it had been before breakfast, as if it were a pall of gray ashes settling toward the earth. The lush fronds of the wind-tossed palm trees rustled and clicked and clattered with what might have been a storm warning. Padding along at Spencer's side, Rocky sneezed a couple of times at the chlorine smell, but he was unfazed by the thrashing palms. He had never met a tree that scared him, which was not to say that such a devil tree didn't exist. When he was in one of his stranger moods, when he had the heebie-jeebies and sensed evil mojo at work in every shadow, when the circumstances were just right, he probably could be terrorized by a wilted sapling in a 5-inch pot. According to the information that Valerie, then calling herself Hannah May Rainey, had supplied to obtain a work card for a job as a dealer in a casino, she'd lived at this apartment complex, Unit 2D. The apartments on the second floor opened onto a roofed balcony that overlooked the courtyard and that sheltered the walkway in front of the ground floor units. As Spencer and Rocky climbed concrete stairs, wind rattled a loose picket in the rust-spotted iron railing. He'd brought Rocky because a cute dog was a great icebreaker. People tended to trust a man who was trusted by a dog, and they were more likely to open up and talk to a stranger who had an appealing mutt at his side, even if that stranger had a dark intensity about him and a scar from ear to chin. Such was the power of canine charm.
Hannah Valerie's former apartment was in the center wing of the U-shaped structure at the rear of the courtyard. A large window to the right of the door was covered by draperies. To the left, a small window revealed a kitchen. The name above the doorbell was Traven. Spencer rang the bell and waited. His highest hope was that Valerie had shared the apartment and that the other tenant remained in residence. She had lived there at least 4 months, the duration of her employment at the Mirage. In that much time, though Valerie would have been living as much of a lie as in California, her roommate might have made an observation that would enable Spencer to track her backward from Nevada, the same way that Rosie had pointed him from Santa Monica to Vegas. He rang the bell again. Odd as it was to try to find her by seeking to learn where she'd come from instead of where she'd gone, Spencer had no better choice. He didn't have the resources to track her forward from Santa Monica. Besides, by going backward, he was less likely to collide with the federal agents or whatever they were following her. He had heard the doorbell ringing inside. Nonetheless, he tried knocking. The knock was answered, though not by anyone in Valerie's former apartment. Farther to the right, along the balcony, the door to 2E opened, and a gray-haired woman in her 70s leaned her head out to peek at him.
"Can I help you?"
"I'm looking for Miss Traven."
"Oh, she works the early shift at Caesar's Palace. Won't be home for hours yet."
She moved into the doorway, a short, plump, sweet-faced woman in clunky orthopedic shoes, support stockings as thick as dinosaur hide, a yellow and gray house dress, and a forest green cardigan. Spencer said, Well, who I'm really looking for is... Rocky, hiding behind Spencer, risked poking his head around his master's legs to get a look at the grandmotherly soul from 2E, and the old woman squealed with delight when she spotted him. Although she toddled more than walked, she launched herself off the threshold with the exuberance of a child who didn't know the meaning of the word arthritis. Burbling baby talk, she approached at a velocity that startled Spencer and alarmed the hell out of Rocky. The dog yelped, the woman bore down on them with exclamations of adoration, the dog tried to climb Spencer's right leg as if to hide under his jacket, the woman said,
"Sweetums, sweetums, sweetums,"
and Rocky dropped to the balcony floor in a swoon of terror and curled into a ball and crossed his forepaws over his eyes and prepared himself for the inevitability of violent death. Bosley Donner's left leg slipped off the foot brace on his electric wheelchair and scraped along the walkway. Laughing, letting his chair coast to a halt, Donner lifted his unfeeling leg with both hands and slammed it back where it belonged. Equipped with a high-capacity battery and a golf cart propulsion system, Donner's transportation was capable of considerably greater speeds than any ordinary electric wheelchair. Roy Miro caught up with him, breathing heavily.
"I told you this baby can move," Donner said.
"Yes, I see. Impressive," Roy puffed. They were in the backyard of Donner's 4-acre estate in Bel Air, where a wide ribbon of brick-colored concrete had been installed to allow the disabled owner to access every corner of his elaborately landscaped property. The walkway rose and fell repeatedly, passed through a tunnel under one end of the pool patio, and serpentined among phoenix palms, queen palms, king palms, huge Indian laurels, and melaleucas in their jackets of shaggy bark. Evidently, Donner had designed the walkway to serve as his private roller coaster.
"It's illegal, you know," Donner said.
"Illegal?"
"It's against the law to modify a wheelchair the way I've done."
"Well, yes, I can see why it would be."
"You can?"
Donner was amazed.
"I can't. It's my chair."
"Whipping around this track the way you do, you could wind up not just a paraplegic, but a quadriplegic." Donner grinned and shrugged.
"Well, then I'd computerize the chair so I could operate it with vocal commands."
At 32, Bosley Donner had been without the use of his legs for 8 years, after taking a chunk of shrapnel in the spine during a Middle East police action that had involved the unit of U.S. Army Rangers in which he had served. He was stocky, deeply tanned, with brush-cut blonde hair and blue-gray eyes that were even merrier than Roy's. If he'd ever been depressed about his disability, he'd gotten over it long ago. Or maybe he'd learned to hide it well. Roy disliked the man because of his extravagant lifestyle, his annoyingly high spirits, his unspeakably garish Hawaiian shirt, and for other reasons not quite definable. But is this recklessness socially responsible?
Donner frowned with confusion, but then his face brightened. "Oh, you mean I might be a burden to society? Oh, hell, I'd never use the government health care anyway. They'd triage me into a grave in 6 seconds flat. Look around, Mr. Miro. I can pay what's necessary. Come on, I want to show you the temple. It's really something.
Rapidly gaining speed, Donner streaked away from Roy downhill through feathery palm shadows and spangles of red-gold sunshine. Straining to repress his annoyance, Roy followed. After being discharged from the army, Donner had fallen back on a lifelong talent for drawing inventive cartoon characters. His portfolio had won him a job with a greeting card company. In his spare time, he developed a comic strip and was offered a contract by the first newspaper syndicate to see it. Within 2 years, he was the hottest cartoonist in the country. Now, through those widely loved cartoon characters, which Roy found idiotic, Bosley Donner was an industry. Best-selling books, TV shows, toys, T-shirts, his own line of greeting cards, product endorsements, records, and much more. At the bottom of a long slope, the walkway led to a balustraded garden temple in the classical style. 5 columns stood on a limestone floor, supporting a heavy cornice and a dome with a ball finial. The structure was surrounded by English primrose laden with blossoms in intense shades of yellow, red, pink, and purple. Donner sat in his chair in the center of the open-air temple, swathed in shadows, waiting for Roy. In that setting, he should have been a mysterious figure. However, his stockiness and broad face and brush-cut hair and loud Hawaiian shirt all combined to make him seem like one of his own cartoon characters. Stepping into the temple, Roy said, "You were telling me about Spencer Grant."
"Was I?"
Donner said, with a note of irony. In fact, for the past 20 minutes, while leading Roy on a chase around the estate, Donner had said quite a lot about Grant, with whom he had served in the Army Rangers, and yet had said nothing that revealed either the inner man or any important details of his life prior to joining the Army.
"I liked Hollywood," Donner said. "He was the quietest man I've ever known, one of the most polite, one of the smartest, and sure as hell one of the most self-effacing, last guy in the world to brag. And he could be a lot of fun when he was in the right mood, but he was very self-contained. No one ever really got to know him."
"Hollywood?" Roy asked.
"Oh, that's just a name we had for him when we started to kid him. He loved old movies. I mean, he was almost obsessed with them."
"Any particular kind of movies?"
"Suspense flicks and dramas with old-fashioned heroes. These days," he said, "movies have forgotten what heroes are all about."
"How so?"
"He said heroes used to have a better sense of right and wrong than they do now. He loved North by Northwest, Notorious, To Kill a Mockingbird, because the heroes had strong principles, morals. They used their wits more than guns."
"Now," Roy said, "you have movies where a couple of buddy cops smash and shoot up half the city to get one bad guy.
Use four-letter words, all kinds of trash talk.
Jump into bed with women they met only 2 hours ago.
And strut around with half their clothes off to show their muscles, totally full of themselves."
Roy nodded. He had a point.
"Hollywood's favorite old movie stars were Cary Grant and Spencer Tracy, so, of course, he took a lot of ribbing about that."
Roy was surprised that his and the scarred man's opinions of current movies were in harmony. He was disturbed to find himself in agreement on any issue with a dangerous sociopath like Grant. Thus preoccupied, he only half heard what Donner had told him.
"I'm sorry, took a lot of ribbing about what?"
"Well, it wasn't particularly funny that Spencer Tracy and Cary Grant must have been his mom's favorite stars, too, or that she named him after them. But a guy like Hollywood, as modest and quiet as he was, shy around girls, a guy who didn't hardly seem to have an ego, well, it just struck us funny that he identified so strongly with a couple of movie stars, the heroes they played. He was still 19 when he went into Ranger training, but in most ways he seemed 20 years older than the rest of us. You could see the kid in him only when he was talking about old movies or watching them."
Roy sensed that what he had just learned was of great importance, but he didn't understand why. He stood on the brink of a revelation, yet could not quite see the shape of it. He held his breath, afraid that even exhaling would blow him away from the understanding that seemed within reach. A warm breeze soughed through the temple. On the limestone floor near Roy's left foot, a slow black beetle crawled laboriously toward its own strange destiny. Then, almost eerily, Roy heard himself asking a question that he had not first consciously considered.
"You're sure his mother named him after Spencer Tracy and Cary Grant?"
"Isn't it obvious?" Donner replied.
"Is it?"
"It is to me."
"He actually told you that's why she named him what she did?"
"I guess so. I don't remember, but he must have."
The soft breeze soughed, the beetle crawled, and a chill of enlightenment shivered through Roy. Bosley Donner said,
"You haven't seen the waterfall yet. Oh, it's terrific. It's really, really neat. Come on, you gotta see it."
The wheelchair purred out of the temple. Roy turned to watch between the limestone columns as Donner sped recklessly along another downsloping pathway into the cool shadows of a green glen. His brightly patterned Hawaiian shirt seemed to flare with fire when he flashed through shafts of red-gold sunshine, and then he vanished past a stand of Australian tree ferns. By now, Roy understood the primary thing about Bosley Donner that so annoyed him. The cartoonist was just too damn self-confident and independent. Even disabled, he was utterly self-possessed and self-sufficient. Such people were a grave danger to the system. Civil order was not sustainable in a society populated by rugged individualists. The dependency of the people was a source of the state's power, and if the state didn't have enormous power, progress could not be achieved or peace sustained in the streets. He might have followed Donner and terminated him in the name of social stability, lest others be inspired by the cartoonist's example, but the risk of being observed by witnesses was too great. A couple of gardeners were at work on the grounds, and Mrs. Donner, or a member of the household staff, might be looking out a window at the most inconvenient of moments. Besides, chilled and excited by what he believed he'd discovered about Spencer Grant, Roy was eager to confirm his suspicion. He left the temple, being careful not to crush the slow black beetle, and turned in the opposite direction from that in which Donner had vanished. He swiftly ascended to higher levels of the backyard, hurried past the side of the enormous house, and got in his car, which was parked in the circular driveway. From the manila envelope that Melissa Wicklund had given him, he withdrew one of the pictures of Grant and put it on the seat. But for the terrible scar, that face initially seemed quite ordinary. Now he knew that it was the face of a monster. From the same envelope, he took a printout of the report that he'd requested from Mama the previous night, and that he'd read off the computer screen in his hotel a few hours ago. He paged to the false names under which Grant had acquired and paid for utilities. Stuart Peck, Henry Holden, James Gable, John Humphrey, William Clark, Wayne Gregory, Robert Tracy. Roy withdrew a pen from his inside jacket pocket and rearranged first and last names into a new list of his own. Gregory Peck, William Holden, Clark Gable, James Stewart, John Wayne. That left Roy with four names from the original list: Henry, Humphrey, Robert, and Tracy. Tracy, of course, matched the bastard's first name, Spencer. And for a purpose that neither Mama nor Roy had yet discovered, the tricky, scar-faced son of a bitch was probably using another false identity that incorporated the name Carrie, which was missing from the first list, but was the logical match for his last name, Grant. That left Henry, Humphrey, and Robert. Henry. No doubt Grant sometimes operated under the name Fonda, perhaps with a first name listed from Burt Lancaster or Gary Cooper. Humphrey. In some circle, somewhere, Grant was known as Mr. Bogart, first name courtesy of yet another movie star of yesteryear. Robert. Eventually, they were certain to find that Grant also employed the surname Mitchum or Montgomery. As casually as other men changed shirts, Spencer Grant changed identities. They were searching for a phantom. Although he couldn't yet prove it, Roy was now convinced that the name Spencer Grant was as phony as all the others. Grant was not the surname that this man had inherited from his father, nor was Spencer the Christian name that his mother had given him. He had named himself after favorite actors who had played old-fashioned heroes. His real name was Cipher. His real name was Mystery, Shadow, Ghost, Smoke. Roy picked up the computer-enhanced portrait and studied the scarred face. This dark-eyed Cipher had joined the army under the name Spencer Grant when he was just 18. What teenager knew how to establish a false identity with convincing credentials and get away with it? What had this enigmatic man been running from at even that young age? How in the hell was he involved with the woman? On the sofa, Rocky lay on his back, all four legs in the air, paws limp, his head in Theta Davidowitz's ample lap, gazing up in rapture at the plump, gray-haired woman. Theta stroked his tummy, scratched under his chin, and called him sweetums and cutie and pretty eyes and snookums. She told him that he was God's own little furry angel, the handsomest canine in all creation, wonderful, marvelous, cuddly, adorable, perfect. She fed him thin little slices of ham, and he took each morsel from her fingertips with a delicacy more characteristic of a duchess than of a dog. Ensconced in an overstuffed armchair with antimacassars on the back and arms, Spencer sipped from a cup of rich coffee that Theta had improved with a pinch of cinnamon. On the table beside his chair, a china pot held additional coffee. A plate was heaped with homemade chocolate chip cookies. He had politely declined imported English tea biscuits, Italian anisette biscotti, a slice of lemon coconut cake, a blueberry muffin, ginger snap, shortbread, and a raisin scone. Exhausted by Theta's hospitable perseverance, he had at last agreed to a cookie, only to be presented with 12 of them, each the size of a saucer. Between cooing at the dog and urging Spencer to eat another cookie, Theta revealed that she was 76 and that her husband Bernie had died 11 years ago. She and Bernie had brought two children into the world, Rachel and Robert. Robert, the finest boy who ever lived, thoughtful and kind, served in Vietnam, was a hero, won more medals than you would believe, and died there. Rachel, oh, you should have seen her, so beautiful. Her picture was there on the mantel, but it didn't do her justice. No photo could do her justice. Had been killed in a traffic accident 14 years ago. It was a terrible thing to outlive your children. It made you wonder if God was paying attention. Theta and Bernie had lived most of their married life in California, where Bernie had been an accountant and she'd been a third-grade teacher. On retirement, they sold their home, reaped a big capital gain, and moved to Vegas. Not because they were gamblers. Well, $20 wasted on slot machines once a month. But because real estate was cheap compared with California. Retirees had moved there by the thousands for that very reason. She and Bernie bought a small house for cash and were still able to bank 60% of what they'd gotten from the sale of their home in California. Bernie died 3 years later. He was the sweetest man, gentle and considerate. The greatest good fortune in her life had been to marry him. And after his death, the house was too large for a widow, so Theta sold it and moved to the apartment. For 10 years, she'd had a dog. His name was Sparkle, and it suited him. He was an adorable cocker spaniel. But 2 months ago, Sparkle had gone the way of all things. God, how she'd cried, a foolish old woman, cried rivers. But she'd loved him. Since then, she'd occupied herself with cleaning, baking, watching TV, and playing cards with friends twice a week. She hadn't considered getting another dog after Sparkle because she wouldn't outlive another pet, and she wouldn't want to die and leave a sad little dog to fend for itself. Then she saw Rocky, and her heart melted. And now she knew she would have to get another dog. If she got one from the pound, a cute pooch destined to be put to sleep anyway, then every good day she could give him was more than he would have had without her. And who knew? Maybe she would outlive another pet and make a home for him until his time came, because two of her friends were in their mid-80s and still going strong. To please her, Spencer had a third cup of coffee and a second of the immense chocolate chip cookies. Rocky was gracious enough to accept more paper-thin slices of ham and submit to more belly-stroking and chin-scratching. From time to time, he rolled his eyes toward Spencer as if to say, "Why didn't you tell me about this lady a long time ago?" Spencer had never seen the dog so completely, quickly charmed as he'd been by Theta. When his tail periodically swished back and forth, the motion was so vigorous that the upholstery was in danger of being worn to tatters. "What I wanted to ask you," Spencer said when Theta paused for breath, "is if you knew a young woman who lived in the next apartment until late last November. Her name was Hannah Rainey, and she..." At the mention of Hannah, whom Spencer knew as Valerie, Theta launched into an enthusiastic monologue seasoned with superlatives. "This girl, this special girl, oh, she'd been the best neighbor, so considerate, such a good heart in that dear girl. Hannah worked at the Mirage, a blackjack dealer on the graveyard shift, and she slept mornings through early afternoons. More often than not, Hannah and Theta had eaten dinner together, sometimes in Theta's apartment, sometimes in Hannah's. Last October, Theta had been desperately ill with the flu, and Hannah had looked after her, nursed her, been like a daughter to her. No, Hannah had never talked about her past, never said where she was from, never talked about family, because she was trying to put something terrible behind her. That much was obvious. And she was looking only to the future, always forward, never back. For a while, Theta had figured maybe it was an abusive husband still out there somewhere stalking her, and she'd had to leave her old life to avoid being killed. These days you heard so much about such things. The world was a mess. Everything turned upside down, getting worse all the time. Then the Drug Enforcement Administration had raided Hannah's apartment last November at 11 in the morning when she should have been sound asleep, but the girl was gone, packed up and moved overnight without a word to her friend Theta, as if she'd known that she was about to be found. The federal agents were furious, and they questioned Theta at length as if she might be a criminal mastermind herself, for God's sake. They said Hannah Rainey was a fugitive from justice, a partner in one of the most successful cocaine-importing rings in the country, and that she had shot and killed two undercover police officers in a sting operation that had gone sour. "So she's wanted for murder?" Spencer asked. Making a fist of one liver-spotted hand, stamping one foot so hard that her orthopedic shoe hammered the floor with a resounding thud in spite of the carpet, Theta Davidowitz said, "Bullshit!" Eve Marie Jammer worked in a windowless chamber at the bottom of an office tower 4 stories below downtown Las Vegas. Sometimes she thought of herself as being like the Hunchback of Notre Dame in his bell tower, or like the Phantom in his lonely realm beneath the Paris Opera House, or like Dracula in the solitude of his crypt, a figure of mystery in possession of terrible secrets. One day she hoped to be feared more intensely by more people than all those who had feared the Hunchback, the Phantom, and the Count combined. Unlike the monsters in movies, Eve Jammer was not physically disfigured. She was 33, an ex-showgirl, blonde, green-eyed, breathtaking. Her face caused men to turn their heads and walk into lampposts. Her perfectly proportioned body existed nowhere else but in the moist, erotic dreams of pubescent boys. She was aware of her exceptional beauty. She reveled in it, for it was a source of power. And Eve loved nothing as much as power. In her deep domain, the walls and the concrete floor were gray, and the banks of fluorescent bulbs shed a cold, unflattering light in which she was nonetheless gorgeous. Though the space was heated, and though she occasionally turned the thermostat to 90 degrees, the concrete vault resisted every effort to warm it, and Eve often wore a sweater to ward off the chill. As the sole worker in her office, she shared the room only with a few varieties of spiders, all unwelcome, which no quantity of insecticide could eradicate entirely. That Friday morning in February, Eve was diligently tending the banks of recording machines on the metal shelves that nearly covered one wall. 128 private telephone lines served her bunker, and all but 2 were connected to recorders, although not all the recorders were on active status. Currently, the agency had 80 taps operating in Las Vegas. The sophisticated recording devices employed laser discs rather than tape, and all the phone taps were voice-activated so the discs would not become filled with long stretches of silence. Because of the enormous capacity for data storage allowed by the laser format, the disks seldom had to be replaced. Nevertheless, Eve checked the digital readout on each machine, which indicated available recording capacity, and although an alarm would draw attention to any malfunctioning recorder, she tested each unit to be certain that it was working. If even one disk or machine failed, the agency might lose information of incalculable value. Las Vegas was the heart of the country's underground economy, which meant that it was a nexus of criminal activity and political conspiracy. Casino gambling was primarily a cash business, and Las Vegas was like a huge, brightly lighted pleasure ship afloat on a sea of coins and paper currency. Even the casinos that were owned by respectable conglomerates were believed to be skimming 15% to 30% of receipts, which never appeared on their books or tax returns. A portion of that secret treasure circulated through the local economy. Then there were tips. Tens of millions in gratuities were given by winning gamblers to card dealers and roulette croupiers and craps table crews, and most of that vanished into the deep pockets of the city. To obtain a 3- or 5-year contract as the maitre d' at main showrooms in most major hotels, a winning applicant had to pay $250,000 in cash or more as key money to those who were in a position to grant the job. Tips reaped from tourists seeking good seats for the shows quickly made the investment pay off. The most beautiful call girls, referred by casino management to high rollers, could make $500,000 a year,
tax-free. Houses frequently were bought with $100 bills packed in grocery bags or styrofoam coolers. Each such sale was by private contract, with no escrow company involved and no official recording of a new deed, which prevented any taxing authority from discovering either that a seller had made a capital gain or that a buyer had made the purchase with undeclared income. Some of the finest mansions in the city had changed hands 3 or 4 times over 2 decades, but the name on the deed of record remained that of the original owner, to whom all official notices were mailed, even after his death. The IRS and numerous other federal agencies maintained large offices in Vegas. Nothing interested the government more than money, especially money from which it had never taken its bite. The high rise above Eve's windowless realm was occupied by an agency that maintained as formidable a presence in Las Vegas as any arm of government. She was supposed to believe that she worked for a secret, though legitimate, operation of the National Security Agency, but she knew that was not the truth. This was a nameless outfit, engaged in wide-ranging and mysterious tasks, intricately structured, operating outside the law, manipulating legislative and judicial branches of government, perhaps the executive branch as well, acting as judge and jury and executioner when it wished. A discreet Gestapo. They had put her in one of the most sensitive positions in the Vegas office, partly because of her father's influence. However, they also trusted her in that subterranean recording studio because they thought that she was too dumb to realize the personal advantage to be made of the information therein. Her face was the purest distillation of male sex fantasies, and her legs were the most lithe and erotic ever to grace a Vegas stage, and her breasts were enormous, defiantly upswept, so they assumed she was barely bright enough to change the laser discs from time to time, and when necessary to call an in-house technician to repair malfunctioning machines. Although Eve had developed a convincing dumb blonde act, she was smarter than any of the Machiavellian crowd in the offices above her. During 2 years with the agency, she had secretly listened to the wiretaps on the most important of the casino owners, mafia bosses, businessmen, and politicians being monitored. She had profited by obtaining the details of secret corporate stock manipulations, which allowed her to buy and sell for her own portfolio without risk. She was well informed about the guaranteed point spreads on national sporting events, on those occasions when they were rigged to ensure gigantic profits for certain casino sportsbooks. Usually when a boxer had been paid to take a dive, Eve had placed a wager on his opponent through a sportsbook in Reno, where her amazing luck was less likely to be noticed by anyone she knew. Most of the people under agency surveillance were sufficiently experienced and larcenous to know the danger of conducting illegal activities over the phone, so they monitored their own lines 24 hours a day for evidence of electronic eavesdropping. Some of them also used scrambling devices. They were therefore arrogantly convinced that their communications couldn't be intercepted. However, the agency employed technology available nowhere else outside the inner sanctums of the Pentagon. No detection equipment in existence could sniff out the electronic spoor of their devices. To Eve's certain knowledge, they operated an undiscovered tap on the secure phone of the special agent in charge of the Las Vegas office of the FBI. She wouldn't have been surprised to learn that the agency enjoyed equal coverage of the director of the Bureau in Washington. In 2 years, making a long series of small profits that no one noticed, she had amassed more than $5 million. Her only large score had been $1 million in cash, which had been intended as a payoff from the Chicago mob to a United States senator on a fact-finding junket to Vegas. After covering her tracks by destroying the laser disc on which a conversation about the bribe had been recorded, Eve intercepted the two couriers in a hotel elevator on their way from a penthouse suite to the lobby. They were carrying the money in a canvas book bag that was decorated with the face of Mickey Mouse. Big eyes, hard faces, cold eyes, brightly patterned Italian silk shirts under black linen sport coats. Eve was rummaging in her big straw purse even as she entered the elevator, but the two thugs could only see her boobs stretching the low neckline of her sweater. Because they might have been quicker than they looked, she didn't risk taking the Cor 38 out of the handbag, just shot them through the straw, 2 rounds each. They hit the floor so hard that the elevator shook, and then the money was hers. The only thing she regretted about the operation was the third man. He was a little guy with thinning hair and bags under his eyes, squeezing into the corner of the cab as if trying to make himself too small to be noticed. According to the tag pinned to his shirt, he was with a convention of dentists, and his name was Thurman Stuckey. The poor bastard was a witness.
After stopping the elevator between the 12th and 11th floors, Eve shot him in the head, but she didn't like doing it. After she reloaded the Korth and stuffed the ruined straw purse into the canvas book bag with the money, she descended to the 9th floor. She was prepared to kill anyone who might be waiting in the elevator alcove, but thank God no one was there. Minutes later, she was out of the hotel, heading home with $1,000,000 and a handy Mickey Mouse tote bag. She felt terrible about Thurman Stookey. He shouldn't have been in that elevator. The wrong place, the wrong time. Blind fate. Life sure was full of surprises. In her entire 33 years, Eve Jammer had killed only 5 people, and Thurman Stookey had been the sole innocent bystander among them. Nevertheless, for a while, she kept seeing the little guy's face in her mind's eye as he had looked before she'd wasted him, and it had taken her the better part of a day to stop feeling bad about what had happened to him. Within a year, she would not need to kill anyone again. She would be able to order people to carry out executions for her. Soon, though unknown to the general populace, Eve Jammer would be the most feared person in the country, and safely beyond the reach of all enemies. The money she socked away was growing geometrically, but it was not money that would make her untouchable. Her real power would come from the trove of incriminating evidence on politicians, businessmen, and celebrities that she had transmitted at high speed in the form of supercompressed digitized data from the disks in her bunker to an automated recording device of her own on a dedicated telephone line in a bungalow in Boulder City that she had leased through an elaborate series of corporate blinds and false identities. This was, after all, the information age, which had followed the service age, which itself had replaced the industrial age. She'd read all about it in Fortune and Forbes and Business Week. The future was now, and information was wealth. Information was power. Eve had finished examining the 80 active recorders and had begun to select new material for transmission to Boulder City when an electronic tone alerted her to a significant development on one of the taps. If she had been out of the office, at home or elsewhere, the computer would have alerted her by beeper, whereupon she would have returned to the office immediately. She didn't mind being on call 24 hours a day. That was preferable to having assistants manning the room on 2 other shifts, because she simply didn't trust anyone else with the sensitive information on the disks. A blinking red light drew her to the correct machine. She pushed a button to turn off the alarm. On the front of the recorder, a label provided information about the wiretap. The first line was a case file number. The next 2 lines were the address at which the tap was located. On the 4th line was the name of the subject being monitored, Theda Davidowitz. The surveillance of Mrs. Davidowitz was not the standard fishing expedition in which every word of every conversation was preserved on disk. After all, she was only an elderly widow, an ordinary prole whose general activities were no threat to the system and therefore were of no interest to the agency. By merest chance, Davidowitz had established a short-lived friendship with the woman who was, at the moment, the most urgently sought fugitive in the nation. And the agency was interested in the widow only in the unlikely event that she received a telephone call or was paid a visit by her special friend. Monitoring the old woman's dreary chats with other friends and neighbors would have been a waste of time. Instead, the bunker's autonomous computer, which controlled all the recording machines, was programmed to monitor the Davidowitz wiretap continuously and to activate the laser disc only upon the recognition of a key word that was related to the fugitive. That recognition had occurred moments ago. Now the key word appeared on a small display screen on the recorder. Hannah. Eve pressed a button marked Monitor, and heard Theda Davidowitz talking to someone in her living room on the other side of the city. In the handset of each telephone in the widow's apartment, the standard microphone had been replaced with one that could pick up not only what was said in a phone conversation, but what was said in any of her rooms, even when none of the phones was in use, and pass it down the line to a monitoring station on a continuous basis. This was a variation on a device known in the intelligence trade as an infinity transmitter. The agency used infinity transmitters that were considerably improved over the models available on the open market. This one could operate 24 hours a day without compromising the function of the telephone in which it was concealed. Therefore, Mrs. Davidowitz always heard a dial tone when she picked up a receiver, and callers trying to reach her were never frustrated by a busy signal related to the infinity transmitter's operation. Eve Jammer listened patiently as the old woman rambled on about Hannah Rainey. Davidowitz was obviously talking about rather than to her friend, the fugitive. When the widow paused, a young-sounding man in the room with her asked a question about Hannah. Before Davidowitz answered, she called her visitor,
"My pretty-eyed Snooky Wookums,"
and asked him to,
"Give me a kissy, come on, give me a little lick. Show Theta you love her, you little sweetums, sweet little sweetums. Yeah, that's right, shake that tail and give Theta a little lick, a little kissy."
"Good God," Eve said, grimacing with disgust. Davidowitz was going on 80. From the sound of him, the man with her was 40 or 50 years her junior. Sick. Sick and perverted. What was the world coming to?
"A cockroach," Theta said as she gently rubbed Rocky's tummy. "Big, about 4 or 5 feet long, not counting the antennae."
After the Drug Enforcement Administration raided Hannah Rainey's place with a force of 8 agents and discovered that she'd already fled, they grilled Theta and other neighbors for hours, asking the dumbest questions, all those grown men insisting Hannah was a dangerous criminal, when anyone who had ever met the precious girl for 5 minutes knew she was incapable of dealing drugs and murdering police officers. What absolute, total, stupid, silly nonsense! Then, unable to learn anything from neighbors, the agents had spent still more hours in Hannah's apartment, searching for God knew what. Later that same evening, long after the Keystone cops had departed, such a loud, rude group of nitwits, Theta went to 2D with the spare key that Hannah had given her. Instead of breaking down the door to get into the apartment, the DEA had smashed the big window in the dining area that overlooked the balcony in the courtyard. The landlord already had boarded over the window with sheets of plywood until the glazier could fix it, but the front door was intact and the lock hadn't been changed, so Theta let herself in. The apartment, unlike Theta's own, was rented furnished. Hannah had always kept it spotless, treated the furniture as though it were her own, a fastidious and thoughtful girl. So Theta wanted to see what damage the nitwits had done and be sure that the landlord didn't try to blame it on Hannah. In case Hannah turned up, Theta would testify about her immaculate housekeeping and her respect for the landlord's property. By God, she wouldn't let them make the poor dear girl pay for the damage, plus stand trial for murdering police officers, whom she obviously never murdered. And, of course, the apartment was a mess. The agents were pigs. They had ground out cigarettes on the kitchen floor, spilled cups of takeout coffee from the diner down the block, and even left the toilet unflushed, if you could believe such a thing, since they were grown men and must have had mothers who taught them something. But the strangest thing was the cockroach, which they'd drawn on a bedroom wall with one of those wide-point felt-tip markers.
Not well-drawn, you understand. More or less just the outline of the cockroach. But you could see what it was meant to be,
Theta said.
Just a sort of line drawing, but ugly all the same. What on earth were those nitwits trying to prove, scrawling on the walls?
Spencer was pretty sure that Hannah Valerie herself had drawn the cockroach, just as she had nailed the textbook photograph of a roach to the wall of the bungalow in Santa Monica. He sensed it was meant to taunt and aggravate the men who had come looking for her, though he had no idea what it signified, or why she knew that it would anger her pursuers. Sitting at her desk in her windowless jurisdiction, Eve Jammer telephoned the operations office upstairs on the ground floor of the Las Vegas quarters of Carver, Gunman, Garrott, and Hemlock. The morning duty officer was John Cotcall, and Eve alerted him to the situation at Theta Davidowitz's apartment. Cotcall was electrified by the news and unable to conceal his excitement. He was shouting orders to people in his office, even while he was still on the line with Eve.
"Miss Jammer," Cotcall said, "I want a copy of that disc, every word on that disc, you understand?"
"Sure," she said, but he hung up even as she was replying. They thought that Eve didn't know who Hannah Rainey had been before becoming Hannah Rainey, but she knew the whole story. She also knew that there was an enormous opportunity for her in that case, a chance to hasten the growth of her fortune and power, but she hadn't quite yet decided how to exploit it. A fat spider scurried across her desk. She slammed one hand down, crushing the bug against her palm. Driving back to Spencer Grant's cabin in Malibu, Roy Miro opened the Tupperware container. He needed the mood boost that the sight of Guinevere's treasure was sure to give him. He was shocked and dismayed to see a bluish-greenish-brownish spot of discoloration spreading from the web between the first and second fingers. He hadn't expected anything like that for hours yet. He was irrationally upset with the dead woman for being so fragile. Although he told himself that the spot of corruption was small, that the rest of the hand was still exquisite, that he should focus more on the unchanged and perfect form of it than on the coloration, Roy could not rekindle his previous passion for Guinevere's treasure. In fact, though it didn't yet emit a foul odor, it wasn't a treasure any longer. It was just garbage. Deeply saddened, he put the lid on the plastic box. He drove another couple of miles before pulling off Pacific Coast Highway and parking in the lot at the foot of a public pier. But for his sedan, the lot was empty. Taking the Tupperware container with him, he got out of the car, climbed the steps to the pier, and walked toward the end. His footsteps echoed hollowly off the boardwalk. Under those tightly set beams, breakers rolled between the pilings, rumbling and sloshing. The pier was deserted, no fishermen, no young lovers leaning against the railing, no tourists. Roy was alone with his corrupted treasure and with his thoughts. At the end of the pier, he stood for a moment, gazing at the vast expanse of glimmering water and at the azure heavens that curved down to meet it at the far horizon. The sky would be there tomorrow and 1,000 years from tomorrow, and the sea would roll eternally, but all else passed away. He strove to avoid negative thoughts. It wasn't easy. He opened the Tupperware container and threw the 5-fingered garbage into the Pacific. It disappeared into the golden spangles of sunlight that gilded the backs of the low waves. He wasn't concerned that his fingerprints might be lifted by laser from the pallid skin of the severed hand. If the fish didn't eat that last bit of Guinevere, the salt water would scrub away evidence of his touch. He tossed the Tupperware container and its lid into the sea as well. Although he was stricken with a pang of guilt, even as the two objects arced toward the waves, he was usually sensitive to the environment, and he never littered. He was not concerned about the hand, because it was organic. It would become a part of the ocean, and the ocean would not be changed. Plastic, however, would take more than 300 years to completely disintegrate, and throughout that period toxic chemicals would leach from it into the suffering sea. He should have dumped the Tupperware in one of the trash cans that stood at intervals along the pier railing. Well, too late. He was human. That was always the problem. For a while, Roy leaned against the railing. He stared into an infinity of sky and water, brooding about the human condition. As far as Roy was concerned, the saddest thing in the world was that human beings, for all their ardent striving and desire, could never achieve physical, emotional, or intellectual perfection. The species was doomed to imperfection. It thrashed forever in despair or denial of that fact. Though she had been undeniably attractive, Guinevere had been perfect in only one regard, her hands. Now those were gone, too. Even so, she had been one of the fortunate, because the vast majority of people were imperfect in every detail. They would never know the singular confidence and pleasure that must surely arise from the possession of even one flawless feature. Roy was blessed with a repetitive dream which came to him 2 or 3 nights every month, and from which he always woke in a state of rapture. In the dream, he searched the world over for women like Guinevere, and from each he harvested her perfect feature, from this one a pair of ears so beautiful that they made his foolish heart pound almost painfully, from that one the most exquisite ankles that it was within the mind of man to contemplate, from yet another the snow-white sculptured teeth of a goddess. He kept these treasures in magic jars, where they did not in the least deteriorate, and when he had collected all the parts of an ideal woman, he assembled them into the lover for whom he had always longed. She was so radiant in her unearthly perfection that he was half blinded when he looked upon her, and her slightest touch was purest ecstasy. Unfortunately, he always woke from the paradise of her arms. In life he would never know such beauty. Dreams were the only refuge for a man who would settle for nothing less than perfection. Gazing into the sea and sky, a solitary man at the end of a deserted pier, imperfect in every aspect of his own face and form, aching for the unattainable. He knew that he was both a romantic and a tragic figure. There were those who would even call him a fool, but at least he dared to dream, and to dream big. Sighing, he turned away from the uncaring sea and walked back to his car in the parking lot.